This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. I want to start today's show by telling you about a book that came across my desk recently. It's a little book with a cobalt blue cover decorated with snarling tiger heads. The book's called Machete by the poet Tomás Q. Morin. Now, I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but in this case, the cover says a lot about the poetry that's inside. Morin's poems are crisp, tightly worded, and sharp as tiger's teeth. He writes about what it's like to be a person of color in America today, but also about memories that bring him joy, like hearing a fellow poet read in a Vermont chapel on a cold winter night. Morin teaches at the Vermont College of Fine Arts and at Rice University in Houston, Texas, where he lives with his family. He's the author of numerous books of poetry and the forthcoming memoir, Let Me Count the Ways, which will be published next spring. Tomás, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Now, you live in Texas. That's where you're connecting with us from. But you've been teaching at the Vermont College of Fine Arts since 2014. So what is your relationship to Vermont?
It's a long one. My first time in Vermont was actually 2009 at the Bread Loaf Writers Conference. And then I went back in 2013. And then I started working for VCFA, Vermont College of Fine Arts, in 2014. And I feel like the majority of my literary family, my closest friends in the writing world, I met at the Bread Loaf Writers Conference and in my work at VCFA. So Vermont has always felt like a second home to me, because even though most of the people that I've met through Vermont don't live there, although a handful of them do, that's the place that connects us.
Since you said you teach at the Vermont College of Fine Arts remotely, and you also teach in Texas at Rice, I'm curious if you've noticed any differences between those two experiences. And of course, Texas and Vermont are two very different places culturally, politically. Does teaching at these two very distinct institutions inform the way that perhaps you see our country?
Oh, that's a great question. Because the program at VCFA is a low residency model, while we for sure do have students who come from the New England area, there are many students who are scattered throughout the 50 states. And even sometimes we get some international students. Because the model is low residency, we only actually meet in Montpelier twice a year. Mm-hmm. So the rest of the time we're scattered. But that said, I feel like the progressive spirit, wonderful progressive spirit of Vermont is so infused within Vermont College of Fine Arts that, it's made possible this kind of learning experience.
You've been teaching remotely. That's something that a lot of professors and students have had to get used to in the past year and a half during the pandemic. What is that experience like? How do you connect with students, particularly around something as potentially difficult to teach as poetry online?
I would often tell my students, if you need to turn your camera off and just sort of like look away and not be staring at the screen, like, please do. I feel like teaching on Zoom is kind of like the equivalent of surviving. It's not thriving. It's so much different than being back in person. I've returned to in-person teaching at Rice this semester, and it's just, we're all masked up, following protocols. And it's just so much better than the prior remote format.
Mm-hmm. And have you returned to in-person readings to promote your book?
I had some in-person events on my calendar that were switched to remote. I was supposed to do the Brattleboro Literary Festival in person, but then that got switched to remote, which I was very bummed out about, because I was so looking forward to seeing my Vermont friends. But yeah, it was not to be, not this year.
Right. Now let's talk about the new book, about Machete. The epigraph is a Spanish proverb, and please excuse my accent here, but it reads, Dios aprieta, pero no ahorca. God squeezes, but he doesn't strangle. What does that proverb mean to you?
To me, it really echoes the spirit of the Book of Job, which is, I was raised Catholic, although I'm non-practicing right now. But the Book of Job has always been near and dear to not just my heart, but I think also a sort of presiding spirit. behind my work, because it, you know, it sort of centers that question of, again, surviving versus thriving. You know, how do you survive what life throws at you? And my translation of the proverb is very different than the English equivalent, which is God doesn't give you more than you can bear. Mm. But when you translate this literally, it's like, whoa, this is a much different relationship to the divine than the English version. And in the book, it leads to, you know, trying to find strategies, right? Strategies, sometimes that's laughter, sometimes that's anger. Yeah, in order to survive these moments where you really have no control. And the whatever you're feeling, the suffering you're feeling feels endless.
I want to build on that and that concept of kind of managing suffering, because mm-hmm. I noticed in the book that you address a number of very difficult kind of current event topics head mm-hmm. on, from racism to police brutality to the migrant crisis. And I wanted to ask about one poem in particular, Whiteface.
Yes.
And it stood out to me first because it's formatted very uniquely. It's like a list. Every line is mm-hmm. numbered. And in
right.
part, it's a poem about being stopped while driving by police and the terrible things that can follow from an encounter like
right.
that, particularly for a person of color. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about this poem and what prompted you to write it.
Sure. The genesis of the poem came from those reports that were in the news quite a few years ago. I think it was some summer, I can't remember what year, but it seemed to me that every week there was a new report of someone dressed as a clown menacing a schoolyard, or, you know, they're just kind of always standing off in the distance. You know, someone would spot a clown, they would call the police, report it.
I remember that. I'd forgotten about those,
yeah,
those stories. They're very absurd in a way.
Yeah, they're so absurd. And I remember telling a friend, I guarantee you, I said, I would bet you money that not a single one of these clown people will get arrested, much less get shot by the police. Mm. Whereas someone who looks like me can leave the house to go on a grocery store run, and I may not make it back, mm-hmm. you know? And so I started thinking, well, so that dovetailed with my thinking of, well, what can we do to survive these encounters? What if we dress like a priest? You know, what if we're dressed like a doctor or like a soldier in uniform, you know? And then the sort of last thing I landed on was, well, what if we paint our faces white? You know, put on a wig, red nose, silly costume. Like, will that give us the chance to at least have someone ask questions before they shoot first? Mm. And it's absurd, you know. It's of course there's absurdity in that sort of concept, but also it's equally absurd that folks can't, you know, folks of color can't just get in their car and go somewhere. You know, I have a friend, I know people who have chosen, made the conscious decision to not learn how to drive so that they won't ever be caught in that situation. And that just, I mean, that just breaks my heart, but I understand it.
You know, with experiences like that, and hearing a story as heartbreaking is hearing that you have a friend who doesn't drive for fear of having a potentially deadly encounter with a police officer. How do you translate that, those emotions, that you know, anger and sadness into something as constrained and kind of pithy in many ways as a poem?
Yeah, I think one thing that's really important that I really try to make room for in the poems in this book, to that end, is tenderness. Mm. So in the poems, I try to make room for the anger, the outrage, but also laughter, tenderness, love. And I have one poem in the book, the title poem, actually, Machete, in which it's almost all anger. And I forgot to put laughter in there. So the last poem in the book, Machetes, plural, goes back and revisits that omission and tries to understand, why did I leave that out? I mean, in that last poem, I reference all sorts of silly things like Talladega Nights, Jerry Maguire, and, you know, and try to make room in the poem for more than just pain.
I wanted to ask you about that set of poems, and the second one you mentioned, Machetes, did make me laugh out loud. You have a line about reclaiming the word Trump, which got me. But first, let's talk about the word machete, because it comes up many times throughout the book, and of course mm-hmm. is the title of the book itself. What is it about that image that speaks to you?
The machete is oftentimes, you know, one of the tools that turns into a weapon in for people who live in agricultural societies during revolutions who don't have access to a gun, you know, to a rifle. And all they have is, you know, what's hanging at their hip that they use every day when they go out to work. And what I love about the machete as a symbol is that it's both a tool for progress, and it can also be at the same time a tool for defending yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, in that poem, Machetes, you reference a reading by the Chinese-American poet Chen Chen in Vermont. And mm-hmm. and you write that Chen Chen's poems, quote, broke the stillness of that cold night in a chapel I'm not sure was ever meant for laughter. And that mm-hmm. line left me wanting to know more about that event and about your relationship with Chen Chen. Can you tell us a little bit more about that night?
Yeah, we were in the chapel that is inside of College Hall on the Montpelier campus of ECFA. And he was a visiting writer, and he just wrote this beautiful poem that I think was later collected in the Best American Poetry, one of those volumes. And the poem it's such a beautiful evocation of love, his deep affection for his partner. And in that poem, him and his partner are just going out and like living their lives, you know, openly and joyfully. And it was such a celebration of just being alive. And it wasn't, and I think what really struck me so much about it was, and it had so much humor, was that it does that thing that really good poetry does, which is it reminds you about the sort of basics of mm-hmm. life, you know? And I feel like many of us writers of color are very justifiably drawn to like the pain and the suffering. And yeah, he just, you know, he reminded me like, oh yeah, there's the joy too. Yeah, on that wintry night, it was just a thing. You know, it felt like it was just a thing that we all needed to hear.
Right. I also wanted to ask about one other poem, A Sigh, because it includes this nod to Robert Frost, who of course is mm-hmm. arguably the most famous poet to live in Vermont. And I'm assuming that the title A Sigh refers to the line in his poem, The Road Not Taken, where he writes, I shall be telling this with a sigh.
Yes.
And I am wondering if you can tell us a bit more about this poem, because it's, you know, it's extremely unique. It's there's a lot of wordplay in there, and a lot of twists and turns. So where did the idea for this poem come from?
Yeah. So I was looking at the one of the more recent translations of Dante's Inferno. I had always wanted to come up with a translation for those famous first three lines. I also wanted to explore the history of, because I'm a translator as well, explore the history of how those three lines have been interpreted by translators, you know, throughout time. So I found 48 different versions.
Wow. 48
different
translations. Of the same text.
Yes, of the same three first three lines.
Wow.
Going all the way back to 1805. So I took the translations of Selva Oscura, which is Italian for the dark forest, right? So I took the 48 different versions of just those two words of that phrase and then put them in chronological order in that poem and stitched them together basically like a collage. The only part of that poem that I actually quote unquote wrote is the first line and a half, and then the very end. And I was just, you know, I just wanted to have fun. And also just, as I said, explore how our idea of that dark wood, you know, that dark forest in our life of trouble, you know, how have people reimagined, you know, reimagined that over the last, you know, 220 years.
And what is your relationship to Robert Frost?
Oh, Frost has been such a great teacher to me through his work. And even through the way he organizes his books of like how to tell a story with lyric intensity and also how to make it rereadable. You know, so it's not just something that you read once, then you move on. My hope is that my poems invite rereading from people. But yeah, he's just, I mean, he even has a poem, a home burial, which is one of my favorite of his poems, that is almost entirely dialogue. So I feel like whenever I revisit Robert Frost's work, I very much feel like he resets the bar for me for what I still have left to accomplish, still have left to attempt that I haven't quite done yet. In a way, I always feel like he is always out ahead of me, you know, as a model. And I'm very happy to chase him because he's such a master.
Well, Tomas, I have one more question for you, and I apologize. It's not about it's not really about you or the poetry, but it's about the book jacket for your book, which I love. And I was just wondering if you have any story behind it or special connection to it, and if you could describe it for us, because it's one of those books that kind of jumps off the shelf at you.
Yeah, absolutely. So when my editor asked me if I had any ideas or suggestions for the cover, this was the first book that I've written where I didn't have a sort of already running list of images that I had been collecting along the way in order to share with the publisher and the designer. And I said, I actually have nothing, but what I can tell you is that so I sent her a picture. I said, I'm going to wear this cardigan, which is a Gucci cardigan that has that tiger pattern on it. Which I bought for myself as a gift with my advance for the book. I'm going to wear this cardigan for an author photo. That's all I can tell you. That's all I can share. So I had no idea she was going to share that with the designer, nor that he would then take that pattern as an inspiration and make the jacket. And it's just so striking on a computer screen and also in person. And I was like, yeah, I think that's it. But then I also, I've been joking. I don't know that I can read from the book in person while also wearing the cardigan. That might just be too like a tiger overload. You know, I don't know that I can do that, but it's, I love the jacket so much. Braulio Amado is the designer, and he's such a genius.
Well, if you could hear me typing just now, I was Googling Gucci cardigan tiger, and I just found it. And for our listeners, you should Google it as well.
If I can just throw in real quick. So I first caught sight of that cardigan by watching the HBO TV show Ballers. Denzel Washington's son wears it in one of the episodes, and it's been you know, out of stock for years and years, but I was able to track one down in Brussels, I think.
The layers of references here are astounding. I love it.
It's like a living poem at this moment right now. What, like one of my poems.
Tomas Morin, thank you so much for joining Vermont Edition.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.